You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
On this week's Lyric Feature, music, romanticism and the sublime. Sometime between the 1780s and the 1820s, something changed forever in European culture. And nowhere was this more apparent than in its music. In this three-part series, Michael Lee explores the changing world of music in the Romantic era and its transcendent idea, the sublime. This is the third and final episode, The Romantic Imagination.
In this series, we've been talking about how, around a couple of centuries ago, the character of music changed. Somehow, it became an art form that spoke not only to the exterior parts of life, the rituals of ceremony, of dance, of theatre, religion, but also life in the abstract as well, of fears, hopes, and dreams, reflecting how the imagination can take us out of ourselves and let us experience the world anew. While much of this involves works that are challenging in scale, whether to listen to or to perform, as we've been hearing over the last 2 weeks, this wasn't the whole story. The sublime could also be experienced in a much simpler setting, at home, whether alone or in company. As it became easier to bring art music home, so too the perception of home itself began to change, offering new opportunities of wonder and reflection. By the time Marcel Proust found himself musing on the simple sources of nostalgia, he was simply acknowledging something that was already, if silently, well understood. Home really was where the heart is, and much else besides. It's evoked in that E minor prelude by Chopin that we heard there, played by Jean-Yves Thibaudet, music composed for a small gathering that speaks very much to the individual. Sentimentality isn't encouraged nowadays. We've become so used to associating the power of emotions with manipulation. However, in this period, sentiment was still closely associated with truth and integrity. The novels of Samuel Richardson and the many sentimental dramas in a similar vein through the latter half of the previous century put sentiment at the heart of any consideration of the motives of the inner, private self, in a way that we almost take for granted now. As the composer Felix Mendelssohn put it, nothing is valid except that which has flowed in deepest sincerity from the innermost soul. His aim was to approach everything he wrote with equal openness, as if to say we deserve to lose and find ourselves in any music, whether it's for the concert hall or the living room. Alicia de la Rocha with music by Felix Mendelssohn and a piece he described as a song without words from his first collection of these, the song number one in E, entitled Sweet Remembrance. Reflecting his belief in the transcendent power of music, Mendelssohn actually debated whether or not he should even give these little pieces for the home individual titles at all. Music, he felt, can arouse the same feelings without the need for words. As he put it, words can be ambiguous, but music alone can awaken the same ideas and the same feelings in one mind as in another. It's as if music could function as writing does, offering a way of reflecting on the world in its own way. In 1839 and 40, Felix Mendelssohn's sister, Fanny, travelled with her husband and young son to Italy, spending 3 weeks in Venice before going to Rome, where they based themselves, finding herself in a new context and much freer to explore on her own than she'd ever known in her native Berlin. Fanny had a wonderful time. She wrote letters, explored the sights, and made connections with people she could never have met otherwise. The experience allowed her to step outside her culture in a very real way, and when she returned home, it stimulated her to write a diary in music, Das Jahr, The Year. We listen to two of these pieces now, June's nocturnal mood, along with its hint of a gondolier song, perhaps suggests Venice, while September gives us a simple melody with a luxuriantly wave-like accompaniment, perhaps recalling a snatch of something she heard then.
Thank you.
pianist Lama Skrije with two pieces from Das Jahr by Fanny Mendelssohn-Hensel. The apparent ambiguity of these diary entries is not to say, of course, that words were unwelcome. Far from it. Like many of her contemporary composers, Mendelssohn-Hensel felt especially drawn to poetry and the rich new tradition of Lieder, the art song, which came to form such an important part of music for the home and for smaller gatherings. This coming together of poetry and music is a distinctive product of this period, creating works of extraordinary concentration and beauty. A good example of this is her setting of Heinrich Heine's thoughtfully emblematic poem, Ein Fichtenbaum steht einsam. A pine tree stands alone in the north on the bare heights. It slumbers in a white blanket. It is surrounded by ice and snow. It dreams of a palm tree which, far off in the land of the morning, grieves alone and mute on a burning rocky wall. In that recording of Ein Fichtenbaum by Fanny Mendelssohn-Hensel, Christina Högmann was accompanied by Ronald Pöntinen. As well as the kinds of abstract longings and thoughts that a piece like that represents, music for the home could literally reflect the sublime mysteries of everyday life as well. Nowhere is this made more obvious than in the work of Robert Schumann. The story of his infatuation with Clara Wieck and his incredible struggle to marry her against the wishes of her father and his former teacher is well documented. Not only do we have letters, diaries, and court records, but the year that saw their eventual marriage, 1840, also coincided with Schumann's Liederjahre, the Year of Song. The many songs that he composed that year included a secret wedding present to Clara, a cycle of 26 songs, one for every letter of the alphabet, entitled Myrten, or Myrtles, a reference to the German tradition of using myrtles in the bridal wedding garland. The cycle as a whole is like an encyclopedia of love around the world, full of interconnections, both textual and tonal, with everything linking to the story of Robert and Clara. Song number 3 presents the letter C. C stands for Clara, and so this song, Den Nussbaum, the nut tree, is the first portrait of her in the cycle, depicting Clara as the dreaming bride-to-be. A nut tree stands outside the house, its branches full of blossom. Gentle breezes lift the blossoms, the sound whispering, telling of a maiden dreaming.
Es grünet ein Nussbaum vor dem Haus. Duftig, luftig breitet er blättrig die Äste aus. Viel lieblicher Blüten stehen dran. Blinde Winter kommen sie herzlich.
The maiden listens, the tree rustles, yearning, musing, she drifts, smiling, into sleep and dreams. The closing words of Der Nussbaum, The Nut Tree, by Robert Schumann, with Bryn Terfel, accompanied by Malcolm Martineau. With marriage and a home established, children often follow, and from about this time, childhood itself begins to inhabit a special place in the imagination. The theme of childhood in the romantic experience, in a sense, symbolized a return to the natural and pure soul, the sublime moment of the emerging person to be. Robert Schumann could well appreciate this intellectually, but in addition, he would become that curious and rare figure in early 19th century society, a father who openly loved his children, enjoyed playing with them, and cared about their education. In 1840, of course, all of that was still to come, but already by then, he'd published his first reflection of childhood with a set of piano pieces entitled Kinderszenen, Scenes of Childhood, his Opus 15. This collection was intended to evoke memories rather than be pieces for children to actually play. It includes a piece that became probably the most popular, certainly the most frequently printed piano work throughout the entire 19th century, Träumerei, or Dreaming. In later years, this piece took on a life of its own and came to be seen as symbolic of the very soul of Schumann himself, the eternal dreaming child, all emotion and sentiment and deep nostalgia. Pianist Angela Hewitt playing Schumann's Träumerei from his Kinderszenen. Intended to evoke reveries of childhood, in a way, these pieces are also Schumann's response to Mendelssohn's Songs Without Words, though in this case, Schumann had no difficulty in giving each of his pieces a title of its own. As he put it, if poets try to encapsulate the meaning of a whole poem in a heading, why should musicians not do the same? So, as well as Dreaming, there is Of Foreign Lands and Peoples, A Curious Story, An Important Event, Night of the Hobby Horse, and so on. It's possible to imagine Schumann in the act of composing these, improvising, humming to himself, lost in reverie. He even paints the picture for us. Wearing his journalistic hat now, this is how he begins his review of Mendelssohn's Songs Without Words. Who has not sat at an upright piano in the fading light and unwittingly sung a quiet tune while improvising? We're being invited into his private world to echo his impressions and state of mind. 10 years after Kindertsenen, Schumann by now had children of his own. As his eldest, Marie, grew up, he found himself writing little pieces for her to play as gifts to help her with the piano. And in 1848, when much of Europe was in the fervor of political uprising, he organized these into a collection, Album für die Jugend, Album for Young People. Schumann enjoyed his children's company, wanted them to grow up well and have good experiences. So these pieces are geared for them, for their small hands and growing imaginations. They're quite short, so let's listen to three of them. The opening piece, simply entitled Melody, then The Happy Farmer, with its jaunty offbeat notes in the right hand, and finally, for a change of mood, First Loss, apparently alluding to the death of a bird that the children had been very fond of. Norman Schettler playing three pieces from Schumann's album for young people, Album für die Jugend, Opus 68. We heard Melody, The Happy Farmer, and First Loss. Just as Fanny Mendelssohn-Hensel had done, so too Robert Schumann crafted pieces for the piano that, in a way, act as diary entries, reflecting inner observations and changes of perception. We can hear it in his songs of 1840, marking the steps to his wedding day. The solo piano pieces are, however, more difficult to verbally interpret, especially the music that he wrote in his last difficult years. Mystery and speculation surrounds what afflicted Schumann before his death, whether it was purely mental illness or a complicated cluster of different factors, a situation not helped by the poor treatment and lack of compassion and understanding that he received both before and after his passing. It remains something that we really won't fully understand. The last piano work he completed was the Ghost Variations, so called because he believed he was visited by spirits who played him music, promising wonderful revelations, or voices of angels who then turned into demonic voices attended by terrible music, telling him he was a sinner whom they planned to cast down into hell. In February of 1854, he wrote down a chorale-like theme he said was sung to him by these spirits, and then set about composing a set of variations. A few days later, he attempted to die by suicide. The music is calm, detached, simple, like a devotional piece. It gives nothing away, yet its timing inevitably means that we're tempted to view it like Van Gogh's last paintings, listening for signs. While we can't hear this music as he would have, it nevertheless remains a tantalizing, tragic document.
Thank you.
Piotr Andrzejewski with part of Schumann's last work for solo piano, The Ghost Variations. A way of looking at the role or position of the Romantic artist is to think about that most popular of images from the time, of the artist as the solitary wanderer observing the world, both the world of society and the natural world at large. One only has to remember the wonderful paintings of Caspar David Friedrich, especially the one showing the wandering figure aloft amongst the mountains. There he is, looking across a sea of fog, facing the sublime unknown landscape, meeting the power and mystery of nature head on, both confidently and thoughtfully. Here we return to the conception of a limitless sublimity with which we began this series, this new world of the imagination that, of all art forms, music seemed best able to reflect. Even still, this also changed music. This was seen not only in the way that it dealt with the vast scope of the epic imagination, looking to see the universe afresh, but also, as we've heard, in reflecting singular personal experience of our own little dot on the landscape. We see the freshness of this vision most especially perhaps in the work of Franz Schubert, whose music looks both back to the past and deep into the future, as well as into the heart of his subjects. He documents the poetic romantic wanderer again and again in his music, and most especially in his songs, discovering something new each time. One of the finest poems on this theme is the second of Goethe's two Wanderer's Night songs, an absolutely breathtaking poem which Schubert set to music. In translation, the text goes like this: "Above all the peaks, there is peace. In the treetops, you feel barely a breath of air. The little birds in the forest are silent. Wait. Soon you too will be at rest." The second Wanderer's Nachtlied by Goethe and Schubert, sung there by Peter Schreier with Andras Schiff at the piano. For composers of this period, the power of song was both a new discovery and also a means of drawing from a deep well of tradition. a feeling for the mystery of art, and more generally, not only in songs, for creating musical forms that invited discovery and rediscovery from each who performed it, marked a significant turn in our experience of music. It wasn't enough for music just to be played. It needs to be interpreted, to have its energies realized and experienced by the performer and appreciated by the listener. This perspective took a while, decades even, to develop, but once in place, it was as if it had always been like that. We hear it even in this gentle song, also by Schubert, Des Fisches Liebesglück, The Fisherman's Joy in Love, a simple rocking barcarolle evoking the softly lapping waves as two lovers spend a happy, private moment together and the stars shine gently on. We hear soprano Anna Prohaska, accompanied at the piano by Eric Schneider.
Thank you.
The Romantic Imagination was written and presented by Michael Lee, and that was the third and final part of our mini-series Music, Romanticism and the Sublime. You can listen back to the programmes via the RTE radio app or on the Lyric Features webpage. For copyright reasons, this series is not available to podcast.
You're listening to the Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
The series producer is Owen O'Kelly.